Hello, and welcome to New Books in East European Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Lane, and today I will be talking with Michael Bernard and Jan Kubik about their recent book, 20 Years After Communism, The Politics of Memory and Memoration, published by Oxford University Press.
Hello, Michael, Jan?
Yes?
How are you folks doing?
Very good.
Okay, and it's a pleasure to have you on today. And before we get started talking about your book, 20 Years After Communism, The Politics of Memory and Commemoration, which is published by Oxford, tell me a bit about how you got interested in East European history or politics. I'll talk with you, Michael, since you are not a native of the region, as far as I know.
Oh, that's right. I was actually early on very interested in Russia and more economics than politics and history. But when I went to graduate school, it was the Brezhnev era, and I got completely bored with Russia. And much more interesting things were happening both in Hungary and Poland. So I thus became much more interested in Eastern Europe, and I gradually drifted away from economics and more in the direction of the study of politics.
Okay. And Jan, I know you're from the region. Did you want to add anything?
Well, maybe. The thing is that when I ended up in Colombia, where I met Michael, although he was in political science, I was in anthropology. For a moment, I thought that I will be an Africanist. And I started moving in this direction, but then I got scared that learning all those new languages was not going to be a picnic. So I chickened out in a way and went back to my sort of natural interest in Eastern Europe. And that's how it started.
Interesting. I hadn't realized you'd been at Columbia as well. So moving from there, how did this particular project come about?
Well, we were both invited to a panel by Krzysztof Jasiewicz at what was then AAASS and has since become ASIS, and it was on the 20th anniversary. And there were a bunch of us there, including Jan and I. And do you remember who else was there, Jan, speaking on that?
No. Andrzej Tymowski, maybe? I don't remember.
Yeah, and I think Piotr Wlewski from Toronto.
Yeah.
So it started off fairly Poland-centered originally?
Yes, it was about the painfulness of the 20th anniversary commemoration in Poland.
And what was painful, just to refresh people's minds about that, and particularly in Poland?
There was a tremendous conflict. It was absolutely puzzling to us for a while that in the country that had the biggest anti-communist revolution and the Solidarity Movement, and both those elements, you know, Poland as the leader of the struggle against communism, this massive movement, were extremely attractive as a potential material for promoting the country, right? Showing the world with a united face and the face of a hero in a way. Mm-hmm. So a fantastic material for PR, for propaganda, for promotion. And it was completely wasted in a way because they were in Poland, inside of the country. Moreover, inside of the Solidarity Movement, or former members, prominent members of the Solidarity Movement, were fighting over that legacy and that memory in a pretty vicious and intense way. So we thought this is really interesting and let's start investigating. And both of us have a kind of comparativist temperament. So in order to understand something, we assume we need to look at other cases and see how it works elsewhere to get a better sense of what's going on in Poland and in the whole region. And that's how it started, in my memory at least.
Yes. And then we were able to garner some resources and hold a workshop at Florida where we where we recruited a bunch of other people who were experts in particular countries to come in and use a joint theoretical framework that Jan and I developed prior to that first workshop. And we got people to commit to trying to use that framework and also criticizing it so we could refine it. So we recruited a bunch of well-known experts. So for Hungary, we recruited Anna Szalai. For Romania, Grigo Papaelikesh. We got Kevin Deegan Kraus to do Slovakia, and then he decided that he wanted to co-write with Carol Leff and Sharon Volchik, and we said, well, what the heck's wrong with that? Nothing. And Dani Gliedis did the Baltic countries along with Laura Ardava, a graduate student who she had met during her fieldwork there. Oksana Chevelle did Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Connor O'Dwyer did the Czech Republic. David Art did Germany, Benelin Ganev did Bulgaria, and Aida Hozic did the former Yugoslav states.
Yeah, it's quite a star-studded cast, really, when you look at it, and quite comprehensive in taking in Eastern Europe. I guess the only place, you know, outside of Russia that I don't think I see is Belarus, but that's a particular case in itself anyway, isn't it?
Well, go ahead, Jan.
Well, the idea was, at the moment we started working on the theoretical framework, we realized that the dynamic of any kind of politics, including the politics of memory, is very different in a democratic setting, even if this democratic setting is not perfect, by comparison with authoritarian cases. And then that was one of the first considerations to limit the case selection. But then we were playing with the idea of having some kind of more different case. And we ended up with having Ukraine as that kind of case that is somewhat outside of the other members of the sample, sort of less democratic, less consolidated democracy, certainly with more all kinds of troubles. But it proved to be a good choice because it gave us the kind of almost an experimental contrast.
And for readers, they should be aware that the essay and the book does not include the events of 2013, 2014.
No.
So, which is fine for because it's all focused on what it meant to celebrate 20 years on. Well, you know, you've mentioned your analytical categories and your method here. Why don't you elaborate a bit more about the specifics of that that aspect of the project?
Oh, I guess maybe I can talk about the actors, and then you can talk about the kinds of regimes that result, Jan. How's that?
Okay.
So in thinking about the Polish case and other cases that we knew a lot about, we tried to think about whether there were archetypes of different kind of actors who took different positions on memory issues. And then we came up with a kind of fourfold typology, which includes most notably the idea of the Memnonic warrior, the actor who believes that they have a definitive view of history and who struggle tirelessly to try and convince or coerce everybody else in the polity that that's the way the past should be interpreted. Then we had Memnonic pluralists who, while having their own interpretation of the past, were willing to admit that there might be other ways of thinking about the past and trying to enter into dialogue about the best way to understand the past. Then we had Memnonic abnegators, which were actors who did not care to dwell on the past at a particular moment. This would be perhaps out of trying to avoid conflict, or perhaps they find it to their advantage not to raise certain issues about the past at certain times because it would not work to their advantage. And we also talked about a fourth type, the Memnonic perspectives, who are future-oriented and sort of have solved the riddle of history, a kind of formation that is well known to students of the region through the way that the communists thought about history. But we really found that in our exploration of the post-communist period, an almost complete absence of perspectives.
See. Okay. And the regimes? And,
yes. So once we had those types of actors, which really helped us to organize and order quite a bit of information and see, you know, the patterns of both thinking and behavior a bit more clearly, we started looking at combinations. We came up with the idea that there are three basic types of memory regimes: fractured, pillarized, and unified. And technically, the definitions emerged very, very nicely, that a fractured regime was a regime in which there was at least one warrior. A pillarized was a regime in which there was no warrior, but at least one pluralist. In that case, the pluralist was setting the tone. So it was very much based on Leibhardt's ideas that there are systems in which people who may have very different views politically or representing different constituencies may coexist once they find a way to tolerate each other and develop some kind of a mutually agreeable platform of working together despite of differences. So that was the guiding idea, well known in political science. But in this case, we used it to think about the memory regimes. We were kind of sensing that this is difficult and may be rare, but nonetheless, it was important theoretically. And then finally, particularly coming from the field of the studies of communism, state socialism, we were looking at something that we called a unified memory regime. That was something that was, of course, somehow developed and maintained under the totalitarian phase of communism. And we were suspecting that this kind of regime can come about in basically two ways. One, by the imposition from the top, and say something similar to preventive censorship of communism. Of course, we didn't expect this case among the democratic set of countries, but we thought that maybe there may be, at least theoretically, quite feasible a situation where someone would achieve, at least near-perfect hegemony, and one view would be dominant. Well, another possibility was that there will be no warriors, no pluralists, and that would be sort of a situation where, you know, nobody even sort of thinks about competing over a memory of some fragment of the past. Once this was set up, another task was to specify further the empirical field we were going to be looking at. And we were, of course, aware of this enormous amount of writing about memory and the politics of memory, particularly the whole discussion about, you know, the individual memory versus collective memory of various subcultures and subgroups, memory of families, memory of towns, memory of cities, memory of classes, you know, you name it, right? And everything, of course, is being studied. There was all way too much. So we made some kind of drastic decisions. We said we're going to be looking at only a set of memory regimes that are national, that are prominent in the national space. So we called it a national memory field. The concept of memory field emerged also, which is a set of memory regimes that exist in a given national field in a given moment. It can change, it does change over time. Once we had this defined, then we said that, you know, we observed, at least hypothetically, a given actor may engage in a memory regime either as a warrior or as an abnegator or as a pluralist. And then it occurred to us that in another memory regime, you can play a different role, right? So you can be a warrior in one memory regime, an abnegator in another. And I think I'm still very proud of this. This is a very, very, I think, solid idea, which many people do not pay attention to. They think that those would assume that those types are sort of fixed. You know, once you behave in a certain way in one memory regime or one memory contest, you will be behaving like that in other situations. And we discovered empirically that's not necessarily the case. So that was also nice. And then, you know, another final delineation was that memory regimes of interest to us are those that are constructed by governments and or political parties, and we call them official. So within the national space, we were interested only in looking at official memory regimes that were created to commemorate the fall of communism 20 years earlier. So it looks, you know, it is pretty, we think, nicely, precisely defined set, which then we were assuming would allow us to do a much more rigorous comparison than it is usually done. And, well, I think we still believe that this worked.
Oh, well, it's certainly compelling reading for me. Why don't we talk about some of the examples, and perhaps you could give an example before we go into individual countries. Perhaps you could name some that present that example of someone who's a memory warrior in one case but becomes an abnegator in another, so people have a clear idea of what you're getting at there.
Oh, let's see. The Slovak case is very good for that. So one good example was that Smer and Fico was very much an abnegator with regard to the events of 1989. Mm-hmm. Right, they have a very unambiguous role in that, you know, many of its part of its base of support came from the former communists, and so they had a very sort of indescript attitude towards the events of 1989. While they were, for instance, much more, they would talk much more enthusiastically, let's say, about the Slovak uprising of 1944. Another good example there would be the remnants of Mečiar's party in Slovakia as well. They too were not particularly excited about the commemoration of 1989, but were much more excited about commemorating the Velvet Divorce from the Czech Republic as being much more of an important kind of foundational sort of event. And so different parties in Slovakia often talked about different events as what was most important to them, and were perhaps most aggressively pressing that at different times in the calendar of memory.
And if I recall correctly, part of the problem here is that because the events of 1989 are a shared experience, it was disruptive for thinking about the divorce that came afterward. Is that correct?
Well, it is interesting because the dynamic in the Czech Republic was very different, right? And then, you know, Michael always liked the Slovak case, and I always liked the Czech case, perhaps because my grandfather was Czech, and I have this tremendous weakness for Prague. my mother was born in Prague, by the way. So in the Czech case, we have this one, the only one, actually pillarized case, where we amassed, or Dwyer did, a fair amount of evidence that people were saying something like, yeah, I remember the past in a certain way, but if you want to remember it differently, all right, it's not a big deal. I mean, it almost was like that. So that this degree of tolerance and pluralism for other ways of remembering the fall of communism was most pronounced, that we decided quite clearly. of all of our cases. So the only regime that we called a memory regime that we called pillarized was actually in the Czech Republic. The government was kind of not particularly interested in the celebrations. It was another thing. And what the leaders of commemorating were the student organizations, which was also a unique situation among our cases. So it was civil society and civil society actors that were engaged in building this memory regime, but building it based on the degree or the level of tolerance and pluralism that we didn't see in other cases.
And you draw the comparison between Slovakia, but you know, isn't that an example though of how, you know, going back to 1918, Czechs were always comfortable claiming the role for the whole nation as, or the whole entity of Czechoslovakia, whereas Slovaks, were a bit more focused on the Slovak cause. Is that part of the issue?
It didn't come up that much in this. I think that what those two case studies show was this. The significance of the or the dominance, not exclusive sort of causal power, but the dominance of the state of the political game at the time of commemoration. You know, we one of the big assumptions that we're making, and I think it is confirmed, and many people who study the politics of memory would agree with us, that the politics of memory is about the politics of today, mm-hmm. about the past that doesn't exist in obvious way, but is only sort of recorded in various cultural vehicles. And people fight over that representation or set of representations of the past. And because the political dynamic at that moment in Slovakia was very different than in the Czech Republic, so the commemorations by and large went well, or the memory regimes that emerged were different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things we try to argue strongly in the book is that the politics of the past is instrumentalized, that interpretations of the past, particularly taken by the kinds of actors we were interested in, those in control of governments and states and those contesting the power of governments and states, really has to do with the state of politics at a given time, and that those interpretations are conditioned on gaining political advantage in the present. And we've described that, as I've said, as the instrumentalization of the past.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we move into this, you know, we've talked about this one pillarized example, you say, in the Czech Republic. I know that this project began clearly with the issue of mnemonic warriors, but why don't we move first to the unitary or example or unified example, mm-hmm. and for some examples of that, and because I think we see this in some rather different places and some unexpected, given what you said about democracy and such.
I think the most shocking, one of the more shocking findings comes out of the brilliant case done by Aida Hozic about the former Yugoslavia. And for the former Yugoslavia, 1989 is the beginning of the time of troubles. The most significant event of 1989, of course, was the Milosevic speech at the Field of Blackbirds. Mm-hmm. And so in five of the Yugoslav Republic, Slovenia is an outlier. There was a really, it was really an uncontested event, an event which was more about forgetting than remembering. And everybody basically was an abnegator, that nobody felt that it was to their advantage to press a divided kind of notion of memory on the 20th anniversary of 1989. It was simply because of ethnic cleansing, because of war, because of the deep divisions within those societies and across those societies, there was very little sort of new myth-making that played up the divisions of the past. And this led to any number of really interesting results. For instance, the strongest actors in pushing forward a commemoration of 1989 tended to be West European and German foundations, which wanted to commemorate 1989 as an important European event. But for many of the former Yugoslavs, this was too painful a memory to reopen 20 years later. So everybody abnegated, and they were unified in their determination not to either celebrate or denigrate 1989, but really to try and forget about it. And that was really remarkable. My favorite example there was a case where, I believe it was in Serbia, where a foundation paid for a replica of the Berlin Wall to be created in downtown Belgrade. And even before there could be an event, there was a strong windstorm, and that blew the mock-up of the wall down and away, which I thought was incredibly emblematic of what things were like in those five countries, in Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, Montenegro, and Macedonia.
And so this was one type of non-fractured or unified memory regime, and we came up with the name for it, the deliberate abnegation. Mm-hmm. And then we had the second pattern, which is very different, and which we call depoliticization. And this is an interesting set of countries, because this is Bulgaria, Germany, and the Czech Republic, which is pillarized, right, but certainly non-fractured. In each of those countries, one way or another, this anniversary was simply did not become a platform for any kind of mnemonic conflict, but for very different reasons. So I already described the Czech Republic. In Bulgaria, as Venelin very precisely described, it was the whole kind of cultural syndrome revolving around some strong degree of nostalgia after state socialism, which there's quite a bit of evidence from surveys and other interviews, other sources, is this nostalgia, the level of this nostalgia is stronger in Bulgaria than in any other place. So it was this kind of confusion. I mean, if you think relatively well about the communist past, then you're not going to be particularly enthusiastic about celebrating or commemorating the downfall of state socialism. And that was exactly what happened. It was kind of lukewarm and not particular. There was no particular energy or interest, but nothing even remotely approaching, you know, the intensity that we saw, say, in Poland or in Hungary, or even Romania, which is another thing.
The German case was fascinating as well, because, of course, November in the memory calendar of Germany is a minefield. It not only has the fall of the wall, but the fall of the Kaiserreich and Reichskristallnacht, right, on the same month. Furthermore, we know how much the Germans have devoted to developing a culture of contrition following the Historiker Strike in the 1980s. And there was great reticence to, shall we say, trespass on that kind of that unified culture of contrition that existed in Germany. And there were some actors who could have potentially been warriors, but they decided that it was simply not worth their while to try and play that card. You could imagine arch nationalists seeing 1989 as a real important event because of the unification of Germany. At the same time, there are groups in the former East Germany and the West German left who are somewhat, are somewhat nostalgic for what was lost when the GDR perished. Yet at the same time, they didn't think that attacking the idea of unification because of the loss of the social state in East Germany was a winning issue for them. And so the culture of contrition really constrained what actors could do, and very, very few people tried to treat 1989 there as other than a kind of celebration.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the contrition. I'm just wondering, was there, given the coincidence of the Berlin Wall coming down and Kristallnacht, did that particular issue coincidence play a role in that, or was it a broader concern about this culture of contrition you were talking about?
Well, I think David Art argues that the culture of contrition was almost in some sense hegemonic, and that trying to move German memory off of that was dangerous for any actor who would consider it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's another thing that, you know, the culture of contrition has tremendous institutional sort of infrastructure of all kinds of institutions, the state and the land level and then civil society. And nobody has a machinery to deal with the past as developed as the Germans, for obvious reasons. So in this case, just another celebration, another possibility to use this machine in a very powerful sort of unified way. And this is exactly what happened. So it was very tightly, precisely run as a major state event. And any attempt, as Michael precisely described, to challenge it would have been extremely costly. So all those actors who might have potentially be thinking about challenging it, abnegated, and you had a very unified set of celebrations. Again, it needs to be emphasized on that particular, or it is all happening in this particular memory regime. Mm-hmm. Of course, on other issues, which in our language would mean in other memory regimes, the dynamic may be very different.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, that brings us to the mnemonic warriors and the fractured memory regimes. And we're going to, I think we'll end up with Hungary and Poland because those are both in the news right now anyway. And the Romanian case is probably not as well known, and it's worth knowing, and it has its own peculiarities. So why don't you talk a little bit about that first?
Well, the most important thing is that the commemoration came in the middle of a highly contested presidential election, where on the one hand there were two camps. I need to figure out who were the actors here. So give me a second.
Sure.
On who the two presidential candidates were. I'm sure Marshall Poe can do a good job of editing this stuff out. On the one hand, there were two parties that were split out of the National Salvation Front. Just give me a second.
Well, one was Basescu and one was
Joanna. Were the two candidates. And of course, Basescu was well known for kind of turning his back on the communist past and creating a truth commission in Romania, which played a big role in politicizing this. At the same time, the National Liberals and the National Peasant Party teamed up with Joanna to attack Basescu for doing this, and a kind of nasty politics of recrimination over who had the right to speak about 1989 seeped its way into the presidential election. This then was all completely diffused by a group of Timișoara veterans who said that neither camp had a right to speak in the name of the people who made the revolution. And so there was this very nasty kind of Memnonic war going on, and then cold water was thrown on it by the actual participants in the demonstrations in Timișoara.
Yes, the actual contest, among other places, actually again happened in Timișoara, where there were demonstrations and counter-demonstrations, exactly the way sort of our model kind of sets it up or predicts in a way. So that was, there was a lot of sort of national specificity, but at the same time, the lines of conflict were very much sort of specified as happened in our model.
And of course, the very history of what happened in Romania made this harder, because I think until this day, there are rather different interpretations of what 1989 meant, whether it was really an indigenous social revolution or whether it was a set of manipulations by contesting factions of the elite. And I don't think from a kind of historiographical point of view, there's any consensus on this, which makes the whole thing even harder to kind of get a handle on.
Right. What we didn't talk about, maybe we will talk about it, is that, you know, we were not sort of in any sense selecting on dependent variable, right? We were not organizing our or creating those sets of specific types of mnemonic regimes on the basis of observing the regimes, but rather we arrived at this a very careful analysis of the set of independent variables. We might perhaps Chip will have a chance to talk about it more about it. But what generated that set to which Romania belonged generated also other members of that set are Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, and Slovakia. So it's a rather again interesting and somewhat incongruous set. But when you think about it for a moment, for example, from the point of view of our set of our independent variables, this is the set where you didn't have a strong tradition of reforms under communism. The communist parties were a rather hard line compared, say, with Romania, Poland or Hungary to the very end. And what generated basically this set was the existence of at least one strong cleavage, a polarizing cleavage, either ethnic or ideological, and or sometimes, you know, some cases more broadly socio-cultural. But if you think about the three Baltic states, right, and particularly, let's say, Latvia, and you know anything about the significance of Russian minority, which in some places, including Riga, is a majority or not, right? So a powerful presence of an ethnic division, the memory of everything related to communism and the memory of World War II, but also the memory of the fall of communism, is dramatically different, say, among ethnic Latvians and ethnic Russians in Latvia. So that by itself, almost as a powerful variable, generated the fractured memory region.
Well, and to boot, of course, 1939 and 1989 are 50 years apart. And in the Baltics, thus, that year, any anniversary that ends in the year 9, of course, immediately brings together the destruction of Baltic independence in the interwar period, and then the regaining of that independence. And that really strongly pits Russian minorities on one hand and the titular nationalities on the other at odds with each other, because they have rather different interpretations of what the incorporation into the USSR meant and what the regaining of independence means.
Right. I guess I want to say one thing about Romania that struck me is you mentioned in your introduction that sometimes, you know, being a mnemonic warrior can backfire. And that seems the Romanian case is an example where that seems to have been the best example.
Well, you know, until this election in Poland, we thought that in Poland was also backfiring. because Kaczyński, a very classical, quintessential mnemonic warrior, was losing whatever 7, 8, 9 elections before this one, and he persisted, and finally he won. Which only tells you, again, do not predict anything in politics. But you know, the last set of cases, which was the one from which we started, and which is our favorite, perhaps still, is in a way completely paradoxical, because this is the set of cases where you have this thing we called negotiated extrication from state socialism, and this is Poland, Hungary, and Slovenia. So, you know, you might think that, okay, so this is the kind of a smoothest way of getting out of communism, and there were round tables and there were negotiations, and therefore they figured out how to coexist. So you would think they will continue this culture of coexistence, tolerance, pluralism, pillarization, and all of this. And this didn't happen at all. Right, so we identified that the mechanism, which both of us were writing about earlier and thinking about, and the mechanism is rather simple. When it comes to negotiating the negotiated regime transition, you have those who are negotiating on both sides, actually, mm-hmm. and those who are excluded for all kinds of reasons from negotiation, right? And this sets the dynamic that after the negotiation is completed, those who are excluded are beginning to protest, and they are beginning to present the deal, say, at the round table as something that is corrupt, that is rotten, that those who were sitting, the part of Solidarity, say, in Poland, that sat down to negotiate with the communists were traitors, that the revolution is unfinished, corrupted, stolen, you know, all those things are being said, and it creates an enormous dynamic of division within the victorious camp. And that happened in Poland, it happened in Hungary, and it happened in Slovenia. And this is so you arrived at fractured memory regime through two very different paths, right? One is in the set of countries which had the most relaxed reform-oriented communist parties and the transition through pacting. And the other case is where you have very hardline set of communist parties. And in the most classical sort of set of cases, you had a very powerful ethnic polarization that generated this dynamic of the mnemonic war. So I think, was one of the most interesting things. And before doing all this work, we obviously didn't have such a clear sense of that difference.
If we can go back to the Czech Republic for a second, though, because it also had a negotiated end, a very rapid one. And
More of a collapse. And the communists as a political actor were very much sidelined. What's interesting in the Czech Republic is that there was a social democratic alternative that emerged, and the post-communists really didn't reform themselves into a social democratic party as it did in the other cases. So that's really another remarkable kind of irony there. In those countries in which the communist successor parties most strongly distanced themselves from the past, that's where the division occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, that conversion is presented by the warriors as something that's insincere, as something that is evidence that the revolution is complete, because the post-communists were able to somehow burnish their images and return to the fold in politics and be highly effective political parties in the post-communist age. So even though that's really something which in all those cases could be seen as something that worked to advance reform and the consolidation of democracy, was seen as the warriors as prima facie evidence that that the revolution was incomplete because those actors were still there on the scene and were still consequent. And that's not true in the Czech case, because the communists remained hardline. A lot of their support was peeled away by this historical Social Democratic Party, and that made a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. And, this case also takes us to something that we should maybe talk a little bit about, which is our method, which was something that called for a lot of many hard decisions. You know, anybody who is trying to code things, not use the ready-made data sets, but actually go through empirical material, particularly as complex as this, and then code them into a binary scheme of 0-1, which we had to do in order to do our analysis. One of the decisions, which was not that easy, was to actually, as you mentioned, on the Czech and Slovak cases, but as Michael was explaining, we decided to code it as a non-negotiated transition, and we coded as negotiated transitions only Poland, Hungary, and Slovenia. And obviously, this can be debated. I mean, that's the one thing that we always repeat. You know, people can take this.
I think Jan disappeared.
Yes, I fear that has happened. Let me... He's still listed on... Yeah, now he's disappeared. Let me... I think he's back. Jan? He's trying to reconnect. Jan? Jan?
Yeah, I think I lost you at some point.
Yes, you did.
Why don't you go back to that whole judgment and coding issue from the top, I think.
All the way from the beginning?
Yes, you really did disappear there.
Okay. It was on the spur of the moment, I guess, I started talking about it. Okay.
Talking about coding things as negotiated versus non-negotiated.
Yes. So the Czech case is a good illustration of a serious and interesting problem we faced, which was the problem of coding. We had to convert a lot of very textured and detailed qualitative information into very simple quantitative values of variables, and they had to be binarized for our method to work. So we had to decide, for example, whether Czech or Slovak transitions were negotiated or not. And our decision was that they were not, and the only three cases of negotiated transition were Hungary, Poland, and Slovenia. And the point is that it can be recoded. Someone can come up with the reasons to change this decision. And, of course, we would very much welcome such exercises, but you know, the decision was reached after a very broad and deep and sustained over time consultation with the whole team. So this was one of those examples of work where a lot of experts were talking to each other and knowing the cases very well. Together, we were arriving end of staff coding decisions, which, was very rewarding. It was very interesting. But here it is. Czech and Slovak cases were coded, i.e. Czechoslovakia at that time, as non-negotiated, as the collapse.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting insight also into the different perspective that a social science, a more rigorous kind of social science perspective, like political science, the conceptualization is something I don't think the historians I work with would generally even think of doing. So it's kind of interesting insight into
what political scientists can bring to this question of memory.
This isn't mainstream political science, though. This is a kind of political science that thinks of causation as being complex and contingent and looks at kind of multiple factors and how they combine to bring about results. So this is not necessarily mainstream political science, I would say. And it's much more historically informed than other forms of political science. But at the same time, political science think about and use history in ways that's different from the way the profession of historians would, where the devil is really in the details. As generalizers, political scientists sometimes have to move away from the detail in all its nuance and to some extent in order to think about chains of causation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found it enlightening in that way from a historian's perspective. I thought that was it's just something I wouldn't have ever thought of doing. And it works, whether it's exactly, political science, mainstream political science or not. I'll take your word for it there. But it was a valuable way to look at this.
I would add that, in the case of this kind of question, where you are doing something that used to be, or perhaps still is, sort of a classical interest of comparative politics, which is comparing countries, which by definition is at least part of the analysis is macro. This approach, which is also sort of middle N, right, 17 cases, the approach we chose, qualitative comparative analysis, based on a very detailed examination of cases, is the only way to go, to my mind, still. And therefore, I would say that for this particular question, it is actually the mainstream, because it's hard to imagine doing something else, because you have to find this kind of, via media, some path between too much detail and too much often mindless generalization, right? So I think this method allowed us and do that. And I think the result was eventually or is hopefully convincing both to those who want to see patterns and those who are not ready to sacrifice too much historical, cultural, social, and so on detail.
Well, I found it enlightening myself. So I hope that bodes well for others. Let's talk a little bit about the present, because in particular,
we did leave out Ukraine, which is an interesting case.
Yeah, well, if you want to talk a little bit about Ukraine and what that situation was, at least in 2009, and if you want to add anything since then, that's okay too, I guess. If you have any insights,
Oksana did a really great job. I mean, she was focused mostly on 2011 and the kind of end of the Soviet Union. And she really found that Ukraine had a trifurcated politics of memory at that time, which, of course, has changed radically. But she largely found in the West a kind of nationalist narrative that was very strongly anti-Soviet. And then in the East, she found something that was much more nostalgic. And in the center of the country, an attempt to kind of bridge the difference between the two.
Very similar situation to Bulgaria, I would think.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, yeah.
But the difference is in Bulgaria, that was far more widespread. Mm-hmm. And in Ukraine, she makes the argument that there are kind of three different ways of thinking about the past. And just as the book was going into press, of course, the Euromaidan began. Mm-hmm. And we can see that that those divisions have been changed radically by that event, obviously, that there's been a stronger unity between the center and the west of the country, and with the east being something of an outlier. And, of course, with the involvement of external actors, that became even more polarized.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. And as to other recent, and that continues to go on where we're going, although things have calmed down. And we, you know, we do have mnemonic actors, I think, playing a broader role in society right now, particularly with the decommunization laws that were passed. And where that's going to lead, although it's already caused some tension with street naming and such.
Well, there is one more thing that is very interesting when it's particularly clear when you think about Ukraine, is that something we didn't touch, it was the deliberate decision, which is the transnational dimension of memory politics. And we just didn't want to complicate our model and our thinking about this particular set of events. But what you see, obviously, that the memory war or memory conflict in Ukraine is very much transnational, because on the western part, it feeds into the possible conflict with Poland, right, over mm-hmm. the memory of Volhynia and the conflict between Poles and Ukrainians there mm-hmm. over time during World War II and earlier. And in the East, you know, for obvious reasons, that brings to the game the way of remembering that is more kind of Russian than Ukrainian, at least official Russian. And that is something that it could be done within our model, but, you know, for the sake of simplicity, we didn't go there. Although some commentators already pointed out to us both that, well, some people would perhaps would like to see it from the beginning already in the book, but some people suggested that this is exactly the kind of a next step, maybe the next book. But our framework is absolutely capable of absorbing that. Just the game would, if I can call it that way, would become, of course, much more complicated.
Right, and it was not as pronounced in when we were thinking about the events of 2009 and 2011, obviously.
Mm-hmm. What they, as we talk about the present, was one of the questions you raise at the end about the fractured memory regimes is the propensity or the danger they might pose to the towards dictatorship or something. And where do we stand with Orban, and what does it mean in with the PIS victory in Poland?
Go ahead.
Obviously, in Hungary, the memory war that erupted over the commemoration of 2009 was really catapulted Viktor Orban to power. And he has kind of aggressively pursued a completing the revolution kind of agenda, right? He stigmatizes his opponents, because his major opponent, of course, was a post-communist successor party, the Hungarian Socialist Party. And in that sense, he's now moved to, in some ways, to stack the political system to give his party a kind of permanent advantage in elections. As well, the kind of culture in Hungary still remains strongly divided, with Orban on the one hand, but facing a more and even more radical challenge on his right, with Jobbik, that even looks, more aggressively towards the past, and entertains rehabilitation of some of the Arrow Cross and strongly extreme nationalist elements of interwar Hungary. And Orban has been forced on some level to kind of adopt some of that rhetoric, while at the same time painting his opponents as these villainous national traitors who tried to continue to keep the communist power structure in place after the revolution of 1989. And now he, you know, argues that they have triumphed over that and set things right.
Well, but there's one more thing. We haven't mentioned that, and it's a good moment to go back to that for a moment. So among the concepts that are important for our theory is the concept of layering, which basically means that the one memory regime and its kind of cultural content may influence the way that another memory regime works. So in people's memory of X may be influenced by the memory of Y, right? Mm-hmm. So in the case of Hungary, as everybody would expect, the absolutely dominant memory regime is the memory of 1956 and the Soviet invasion. And it played a tremendous role in the way the preparations toward 2009 progressed, because in 2006 you had 50th anniversary. So this kind of mnemonic temperature of the temperature of mnemonic conflict was, or at least remembering, right, was going up and in kind of explodes in the sense that it imposes very powerful interpretive frames on the memory of 89. And those frames come from this big, huge tradition of remembering the catastrophe of the Soviet invasion in 1956. So, you know, by contrast, how heated it is, once we realized that we looked into the Czech and Slovak cases, are there any traces of layering that in that case would be the Soviet invasion of 68? And in none of it, almost, very little, right? We couldn't find anything significant. So the very interesting contrast. But now, given the fact that 56 is this very powerful, paradigmatic memory for Hungarians, actually a set of memory regimes, right? But if you look at friendship or certain signals of sympathy that come from Orban towards Putin, it is absolutely mind-boggling, right? It really goes against sort of, I guess, an expectation of our model, but that's how it happens in politics. But he produces very complicated interpretive sort of situations for himself.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, he now tries to cast the EU as the new evil empire,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is really astounding.
So, you know, what then in our, you know, I guess frame, it would be another case of layering that in this case, the memory is of anything, 56 and 89, you know, anything of importance is now recast by changing the signs of symbolic enemies, right? Mm-hmm. Now they are in the West rather than in the East. So the problem is secular, demanding, rule-imposing West rather than Putin, even in the East, who belongs more to this kind of, I don't know how to call it.
Illiberal and traditional.
Yes, illiberal tradition of the East or some, you know, whatever, something like that. But then you have to reinterpret everything. The choice is then you shut up and you cannot talk as much about 56 as you used to.
Mm-hmm.
And while this reorientation happened, they stopped talking about 56. Certainly they talk about it much less than before.
Hmm. Well, we
thought it was very useful to coming to power, but it was not as useful once they had taken.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
in power. We see really powerfully in Ukraine and the Baltic countries,
mm-hmm.
in some sense.
We are not getting good contact with you at this point. I think now Michael. And what I want to do is close out then and ask you, what do you, you know, this is a wonderful project, and I like the insights you've just given on what's going on in Hungary right now. But what projects do you see in the future?
Well, we are both involved in other projects. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. What project are you working on, Jan?
Well, I am finally finishing the large study Michael is very familiar with on the role of protest politics and civil society in democratic consolidation, Poland, Hungary, South Korea, and Taiwan. And it is it is really Monty Python because it is now for something completely different. But eventually, we both, Michael and I, talk about that maybe one day we will get back to this set of issues about memory and the politics of memory.
And Michael, what's on your plate now?
I'm working with Jeff Kopstein at California Irvine on a new book on the long-term effects of Leninist violence on post-communist regime change. And really what we're looking at there is distal effects of violence, the long-term effects of violence, not the short-term effects of violence. And we're thinking in lines of a very important American social scientist by the name of Barrington Moore, who talked about how previous violence can sometimes pave the way to gradualism and change in subsequent historical periods. So we're really examining the impact that communism and the use of violence on communism had on social transformation, state building, and nation building, and what kinds of differential effects this had on regime outcomes post-1989. I think one of the things that Jan and I have talked about and returning to would be something having to do with a transnational European culture of memory. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that interests me, and I think Jan as well, is what the question of the impact of World War II and where countries lined up during World War II and the degree of collaboration that existed in World War II had on the way that countries think about the effects of Nazism and Stalinism and how that plays into their contemporary cultural politics.
Well, those are a lot of projects. Yep. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this one, and we look forward to talking to you again then when some of those projects are at a different state of production. So we've been speaking with Jan Kubik and Michael Bernard about their book, 20 Years After Communism, The Politics of Memory and Commemoration, published by Oxford. And we look forward to talking to you again. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to New Books in East European Studies, a discussion with authors Michael Bernard and Jan Kubik about their book, 20 Years After Communism, The Politics and Memory and Commemoration, published by Oxford University Press. I'm your host, Hugo Lane, saying goodbye until our next conversation. Bye-bye.